Today we had discretized BF theory with constraints, and the path integral that we had got was we were associating simple representation to every triangle of your triangulation, and the unique Barrett quantity intertwiner to each tetrahedra, intertwining between the four representations corresponding to its four triangles. So here, I want to emphasize that the representation here, I always draw only one for simplex. But that tetrahedra, that triangle, is shared by many four simplices, and in each of these four simplices, it's the same representation that I put. So the amplitude that I have was the sum of all possible representation of a product on all four simplices of a 10J symbol corresponding to that four simplex. The 10J symbol, I had written it in terms of integrals over five unit vectors on the free sphere. So these unit vectors are associated to each tetrahedra. And so actually, you can expand the 10J symbol and write everything like that. So here, there's a little weird thing. It's that you see that I've put n plus and n minus. So that means that actually, when you look at one tetrahedra, that one tetrahedra is shared by two four simplices. But here I put a Barrett quantity intertwiner here, and I put the same Barrett quantity intertwiner there. That Barrett quantity intertwiner is defined by an integral over S3. It means that when I write the full partition function, I'm going to get one integral for that on that vertex and one integral for that vertex. So I've got actually a pair of unit vectors for each tetrahedra. That's why I put plus and minus. Everybody followed up to now? Okay, good. I'll talk about it later. So yesterday I had concluded by giving the behavior of a 10J symbol, saying that it was behaving as the exponential of I times the sum of all triangles of my four simplex of dj of that the dimension of a representation associated to the triangle times I'll call it theta times the dihedral angle corresponding to that triangle. By dihedral angle meaning the angle between the time normals of the two tetrahedra that share that same triangle plus the opposite guy plus other bad terms. So when you look at that, you really realize that what you are describing after all this quantification, simplicity constraints, and all that is actually simply a flat four simplex. So it means a four simplex in flat space where I define really my dihedral angle as the cosine. I mean, as by the cosine of the dihedral angle by being the scalar product of like two time normals, and so on and so on. And and so basically, I've got this bunch of flat four simplices, and you wonder, but where's the curvature? So all the curvature is located as how you glue these four simplices together. You can think of it as like here, this vector, this normal to the tetrahedra as belonging to that four simplex is a priori different from the normal to that tetrahedra as belonging to the next four simplex. And so there's a non-trivial parallel transport from there to there, and that's what creates the curvature in that model. So now that we have defined all the whole model and that we have more or less understood it, we can wonder once again what you can do with it. And so there's people who actually compute the 10J symbol on computers, and it's a lot of fun. And it takes a lot of time, actually. They are not that simple to compute. But once again, we can try to use this model to really see if there's any physics in it. So what we do is that it's the formalism of a graviton propagator by Carlo and others. What we basically do, it's we take a triangulation of space-time, I'll call it T, like triangulation. And we're going to compute that that amplitude, but we're going to insert some observables and a boundary state. So let's say we have some observables which depend on the spins on the boundary of my triangulation. So, and I want to compute it on a state, and by I define that as the sum on all spin, which are both on the boundary and on the triangulation of that observable times the state times my ugly thing of like lots of tangent symbols. And I normalize it by the same thing, but without the observable. So for example, what kind of observable I can take? Like, let's take the case where the triangulation is very simple, meaning, as usual, a single four simplex. That's the only thing that we can do, more or less. So that's a great triangulation of space-time. There's people who've been trying to do it for two four simplices, and it's already horrible. But so the easiest observable that I can take, it's just taking the spin here, for example, and the spin here. So as observable, for example, I'm going to consider like that I want to look at the fluctuation of that area around a certain area, like which is fixed. So I'm going to fix J0 to some like some area scale. And I will compute the correlation between the variation of these areas. Then as a state, what I can take is, as usual, I'm just going to take a Gaussian state. For example, I can say that J1 and all the spins here are peaked around J0. So on all the triangles, I take that exponential of that thing. And sometimes when you have a Gaussian, well, you can also shift it. And if you were doing coherent state, and I will also introduce a phase. Something like that, DJ. So, and now I can put that in here. So I have one for simplex, so I have only one tangent symbol, and you can try to compute what it's going to do. So why do I choose this particular state? Especially, why do I take this phase here? Is that this phase, if I take like the same, like phi zero, when they're all equal, which is the dihedral angle corresponding to the equilateral four simplex. Meaning that, as you see here, I've been picking all these areas around J0. So more or less, what I'm having, it's a four simplex, which is equilateral. Like all the areas are the same. And I'm looking at the fluctuation of my geometry around that state. So in that particular state, I can look, I can define the dihedral angle here, which is the angle between two normals. And I guess in that case, in 4D, it must be equal to minus 1/4, something like that, phi 0. OK, so let me explain why I've put that term. It's that when I'm going to insert that in this sum, the tangent symbol behaves like that. That term is going to select this term. Because if I have that, if I look at this term of a tangent symbol with this one, when I'm going to do the sum of the spins, it's just you're going to get a phase term and it's going to go away. Also, you can check that in here I've got phase terms, which are going to get to create to not cancel this phase. And so when I'm going to sum over all spins, this term is going to disappear. And so I said these two terms are going to disappear. And in the end, you have only one good term, which is the term that corresponding to the area Ritchey calculus amplitude for the flat for simplex. So then what you can do, it's like you can plug all this in here. And you can remove a phase because you know there's no phase. So basically all you have to do is compute some sum of something which is quartic on the J's on a Gaussian. You can approximate the sum by an integral, and you will find that that thing is going to behave, going to scale as 1 over J0 squared. So why is this interesting and not totally trivial? Is that this looks actually like these are just components of a metric. So basically, you're computing something in H, ij, H mu nu, G mu nu with the metric, G lambda rho. And what you want is that this kind of thing behaves as 1 over the distance squared. And here the only distance that I have in my problem is my scale that I fixed at the beginning, J0. And so here you recover that on the flat background, I have the right behavior of the correlations. Okay, that's why it's called like graviton, because you're computing the correlation of the graviton. So here you're happy, you knew it was a flat for simplex, and you recover that it behaves like a flat for simplex. The only thing which kind of worrying is that here you're computing only one component of these things. I mean, there's lots of different components of this thing because these are spin two. And here you only did a check with one component of that matrix. And actually, if you were doing with the others, it would start to fail. And that's one of the problems of the Balakrishnan model. But I'll go and tell you now. Oh, because here I'm just looking, I mean, J is just the area. So if I'm looking at the variation of the area here, I mean, on something, I'm looking, I mean, this is just a function on the metric on my on that triangle. So I'm looking at the variation of the metric.
No, I want to see the connection between
G mu, G lambda, O, this thing. This thing? I mean, this is just the variation of J1 around my background J0.
Yeah, but you have to give it as an operator. And on the boundary, you have some Hilbert space.
I mean, here I haven't talked about operators and everything. That's just a function. I mean, these are just numbers. They're all numbers. I mean, I'm doing a path integral, so there's no operators in the path integral.
Oh, but at the boundary, you have a
Hilbert space. Yes, and so that's the state that I chose on my boundary.
And the operator?
I don't see what you mean by operator here. This is a wave function. It's the Hilbert space of one function on the boundary, and I've chosen one to do my calculation.
So I thought you by O of J at the boundary of T, you mean some kind of operator living at the boundary of T.
No, these are just functions. If you want the operator, O is just just acting by multiplication of these on these wave functions, if it's what you're asking. That is an operator acting on this wave function by multiplication. Ah. Do you just want to know that?
Yes.
you're going to get something that behaves as 1 over j0. Right? It's not very interesting. OK, so here what it means is that for the case of 1 for simplex, this state represents like something which is going to induce some that the bulk of my four simplex is flat. So what you'd like to do later is like to take a bunch of four simplices, put a boundary state, and that boundary state is going to select the flat Minkowski space inside. Well, here it's not really Minkowski space because I'm in Euclidean, but a flat 4D space. So that's kind of everything that you can do in the Euclidean case. So now I'd like to talk about the Lorentzian theory, which everything works the same, but you're using the group SO31. And so SO31, you can look at the representation of it once again. And now we are going to, OK, so first the generators. There's the generator of the spatial rotation and the boosts. And you have two Casimirs, which are just j squared minus k squared. And the second Casimir, which is j scalar k. And this actually, if you write it in terms of ij, this is just epsilon jj, and this is just j ij, j ij. I'm sure I forgot some numerical factors here. So now the representation of SO4 were labeled by two integers. Here you have a non-compact part in the Lorentz group. So the representation are going to be labeled by one integer or half integer and one continuous parameter. The Casimirs on these representations are going to be very simple. Here I'm going to get n squared minus rho squared plus 1 or minus 1. And here I'm going to get n times rho. So that when I'm going to impose the simplicity constraints, I'm going to impose that this is 0, meaning that I've got either n equal to 0 or rho equal to 0. Actually, when I'm going to build the model, I'm going to consider only these representations. Why? It's because if I take a representation of a Lorentz group like that, I can decompose it onto representation of SU2, so on representation on spatial rotations. And here I'm going to get all possible representations, so all spins of SU2, as long as the spin is larger than n. No, sorry. It's explicitly the contrary. So I want a state which is invariant under SU2, so I'm going to impose that n is 0, so that I have one singlet of SU2. So now my simple representation are going to be the ones which are n equal to 0 and labeled by only one real parameter. I mean, everything is just going the same, except that when you raise and lower the indices, then you get to use the metric. But everything I did was just the same. So you can still say the same constraints, and now look at how you're going to translate them in this Lorentzian framework. So the constraint were that epsilon jj was 0. Oh, it's because it's a non-compact. That's the only difference. But everything is going to behave the same way. So I'm just giving what's different. So once again, there will be a unique baryconic twiner, which is given by the average of the integral of the SO31 this time of the tensor product of singlet states. So states which are also of spin zero. And so it's exactly the same formula as before, except you change jj by zero rho. And now all the integrals are going to be, instead of being on S3, they're going to be on the hyperboloid. Meaning instead of S3, I'm going to move to H3, which is SO31 quotiented by SO3. These are basically the unit time lag vectors. So if I'm in Minkowski space, That's my light cone, and I'm looking at that hyperboloid here. It's a three-dimensional one. I can't draw it. Yes. And so everything is going to work exactly the same way. So, and you can do the same calculations and get the same results. So everything I said applies also in the Lorentzian case. So now what I want to say is, I want to say why all that is not working perfectly. So the first thing is that here I've put one intertwiner, but I forgot to mention that, of course, the intertwiner is defined up to any factor that you want. So if you put one intertwiner there, there's a normalization ambiguity. What it means is that at the level of each tetrahedra here, I can add any factor, some function, of a tetrahedra, I can put, I'll call it small a, any function of four representations. And so the Bradycardian model is actually not uniquely defined, there's a whole class of possible models. So if you read all the papers, everybody is actually using different edge amplitudes, and actually you never know with different normalization of intertwiners whether you're looking at the same model or not. So it's kind of confusing. An infinite number of models? Explored? I don't know, usually people use two models, the initial one and the one written by Carlo and Alejandro.
So what's the, is there some intuitive understanding of this normalization in the kid? Like I mean, physically, in terms of what it would mean about physics?
Or? No. The second one is that here, so if you look at boundary states now, you can see that on the boundary, so if I take a triangulation and I look at the dual, what I'm going to get, here I'm talking about the Lorentzian case, so I'm going to get four valent graphs, I mean spin networks, actually, where I've put the Bradycardian twine on each vertex, and I've put simple representation on each edge. So this is very problematic for many reasons. The first one is that it's totally different from what we get in loop quantum gravity. For instance, here we got, am I writing too small? This thing, but it's a, this is a continuous parameter. And this actually is going to be the value of the area operator acting on the spin network. So here it means I have a continuous area spectrum. So it's kind of awkward. But that really comes because here I'm using as gauge group the full Lorentz group and not, I haven't gauge fixed to some SU2 subgroup of that Lorentz group. So if you use SU2, everything is compact, so everything is going to be discrete. If you use SO31, it's non-compact, so you're going to get some continuous parameters. So that's the first problem about that, but this is not the biggest problem, because that's just comparing that model, the spin-form Bradycardian model, to that other model of quantum gravity, loop quantum gravity. So the real problem is that here, you see that I fixed the intertwiner. So I mean, usually the intertwiner, I mean, loop quantum gravity, or I mean, in all these kind of models, if you look at one tetrahedra, so it has these four edges which come through it, which represent the four triangles of my tetrahedra, and the different representation label give you the area of this tetrahedra, but you know that four numbers are not enough to specify one tetrahedra. So you still have freedom of like knowing how your tetrahedra is flat or kind of like whatever you want. And this is given by the intertwiner that you put here. So here, actually, if you fix the intertwiner, you kind of freeze the boundary, the 3D geometry. And for example, in that case, you're going to find that the volume that you have is always zero, the free volume. So it's kind of awkward to have a boundary state which always have a zero volume. So it means there's really something wrong about what we're doing here. So what people were happy, that there was a unique Barry-Crane intertwiner. This is bad, very, very bad. So now what are the different possibilities to try to cure that that thing? I mean, the first, the first thing that you can do is actually realize that here there was normals on every vertex. And I have integrated all of them. But actually, this is a non-trivial variable in my model. So maybe I should take it into account in my boundary state. So instead of defining my boundary state with a Barry-Crane intertwiner, I can unfold the Barry-Crane intertwiner and you put the normals back. Meaning that now my boundary states are going to be weird spin networks where I have not only representations here, so I had zero rows, but also have some data where I have the normals which belong to the hyperboloid. So there's something strange. If I fix the normal here, it means that somehow I've broken the fact that this was an intertwiner. So actually, when I write it like that, the object that I have here, using these kernels, is not a Lorentz invariant. It's only SU2 invariant. So somehow I put an SU2 intertwiner here. So, I mean, why am I breaking Lorentz, the Lorentz invariance, which is the kind of main thing in that approach? Well, actually, I didn't. It's just that now, instead of looking at functionals which depend only on the group elements, on the connection, like you do in loop quantum gravity, you are also going to say that my wave function is going to be a function on, so these are on the edges, but also a function of normals that I put at each vertex. And that functional is going to be Lorentz invariant as soon as I assume that the action of the Lorentz group doesn't only act on the holonomies, but also acts on the normals. And so this is the Lorentz invariant. And so this kind of Hilbert space is totally different from the one you have in loop quantum gravity, but you can still obtain it in a canonical theory. It's some work done by Alexandrov.
So H3 is
only. Oh yeah, I've put it up there at the beginning. These ones, it's because I wanted some vectors which are invariant to the SO3. It's because if it's in that case, I'm going to get like time-like normals to my tetrahedras, so that my tetrahedras are actually space-like. I could have done the other choice. In that case, I would have had to use that hyperboloid here, so meaning that so this one. So meaning I have a vector invariant to the SO2-1, but it means that all my tetrahedras are going to be like kind of like half time-like, half space-like. So you will not be able to define a space-like slicing of my spin foam.
And is there anything preventing you from using
is there any
the
water? Well, is this bottle anyone's? Oh, okay. No, I mean, if you work on that homogeneous space here, SO3 1 quotient by SO2 1, you'll get both type of representations. But the model is more complicated, not very more much more interesting. So in here, so that's my boundary state. So as I was saying, this kind of wave function appears in the
I think my question is, so is it possible to have tetrahedra where some of them you impose n equals 0 and some of them you impose rho equals 0, but use both?
Yes, I'm saying when you use this homogeneous space, you'll get this kind of thing. So again, you can get this kind of wave functions in the approach of Alexandrov, where he works with the Paratini action directly without gauge fixing down to SO3. And so he always works with the Lorentz group. That's just second class constraint. You have to do a lot of painful things. And then you do lots of approximation when you quantize. And you can get that this kind of structure should appear in the quantum theory. But that framework is not totally well defined yet. There's not a clean quantization of it. So there's just hints that this kind of thing should appear in such a framework. And in that kind of framework, you would get a continuous error spectrum. Yeah?
The quantization you just described, I guess that was done by Alexandrov.
Yes.
Which variables is he using? Is he just quantizing the Paratini theory or this?
The Paratini theory. So that's one possibility of how to get around that that problem. So here maybe I just forgot to say that since now you're using the normals as a part of a wave function, you can also say, add another ambiguity in your model, meaning that here I had a normalization ambiguity, but this is just going to become something like here. I can also add a coupling between this normal and this normal. So I can put some coupling. Associated to each tetrahedra. And actually, if you put such a coupling, you can actually, it corresponds to making the links, the gluing between four simplices stronger or weaker. So when you do actually calculation of correlation, it kind of cures the fact that in that model, the four simplices were kind of uncoupled. And so the boundary state, which was imposing that you wanted something flat inside, had problems propagating to the bulk. So if you add a coupling, a non-trivial coupling between these normals, maybe it will make it easier, but just speculation. So now the other way to cure the problem that we have a unique Barycrane twiner is actually to relax the Barycrane constraints. So coming back to one tetrahedra, the Barycrane constraints, so I have four triangles, where if I look at all the couplings between two triangles, so I had all of these constraints here between all couples of triangles, and I had imposed that all of them are zero. Let me call that C1, C2, C12, C13, and so on. So I want to impose that all of them are zero. Now the slight problem is that when I look at the commutation of this constraint, then they are not zero. They're actually something which behaves, which is of order 3 in J. So when I impose that these are zero, it means somehow I'm also imposing that this operator here is zero. I'm also imposing that the next commutator between C12 and J and that operator here is going to be zero, and so on. But this operator is something which is in J4, and so on and so on. So it means that when I'm imposing that the simplest constraint, I'm actually imposing a whole lot of other constraints of higher and order and higher order in J's. So it looks drastic, and actually it's because of that you have a unique intertwiner. It's actually lucky that you find one solution. I know, everybody's tired. So instead of imposing that C12 and C13 are zero, you could actually relax this and just ask that the average is zero. Well, that's a condition on the intertwiner. So I'm looking for intertwiner such that these average are zero. What's interesting is that... Yes. Okay, so these were conditioned on intertwiners. I was looking for an intertwiner that satisfies that, all of these conditions, and so I got that unique thing. So here, I'm actually looking the same thing, average value on intertwiners, and I'm looking for solution. So that's my equation to get my intertwiner. So what's interesting is that you can actually impose these guys, but as well the conditions, if you remember that there was a third a simplicity condition on pairs of triangles which were not in the same tetrahedra. So it means that here, you can do that consistently, these two, and so somehow you would still be imposing like simplicity, but only at a semi-classical level, like an expectation value. But still, you would have a non-trivial bulk simplicity constraint. So this is also a proposal which is mainly being worked out by the group in Marseille. So that's work in progress, and I don't know how the progress is right now. Okay. So I guess that's all I had to say on the Barrett-Crane model. Maybe one last thing that I wanted to say, it's in the case of a cosmological constant, what happens? So in the case of a cosmological constant, you actually, like for example, for BF theory, you're going to go, so the first thing that I had talked was SU2 BF theory. For a non-trivial cosmological constant, you're going to move from SU2 to the quantum group of SU2Q, in which case, for certain values of Q, you've got a bound on the representation that you have. In the Barrett-Crane model, in BF theory, for SO4 and SO3, you're also going to move to the quantum group, to the Q deformation. And you're going to get the same kind of thing that these representations that you put here, like the JJs in the SO4 case of a zero row, in the SO3 one case, they're also bounded when the cosmological constant is positive. So you kind of have this kind of De Sitter horizon, which appears in the spinful model. So that's also because the guy just before me said that he didn't see any physical use for this quantum deformation, but here they appear naturally when you put a cosmological constant. So now I'm just wondering how much time I have left.
6 minutes.
Okay, so let's talk about group field theory. So the amplitudes that I have are this kind of amplitudes. So now what I'm going to do is that I'm going to generate them as Feynman evaluation of Feynman diagram of a certain matrix model or field theory. So if I start with something which has four legs, which is going to represent a tetrahedra with the four triangles labeled by these guys, I can generate these amplitudes by considering that field theory. Well, it's not really a field for the moment. It's just like a kind of like tensor theory, where some of all the J's of J1, J2, J3, J4 squared plus lambda times an interaction term, which means here I'm going to take something which is of order 5. So I'm not going to write all of them. Well, actually, I'm just going to write it like that. There's lots of indices here. All these indices are contracted so that these represent a four simplex. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So if you want, here I have 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, you put the J's, and then 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 7, 3, 8, 9, and 9, 6, 2, 10, and the last one, which is 10, 8, 5, 1. Okay, so this kind of term is going to generate this kind of interaction. And now I want that at each of these interaction, at these interaction vertices, I put that weight here. So that means that I don't have any space, so I'll put it here. I multiply all that by the 10J symbol, which is associated to these representations. So from that, it's pretty trivial that this is going to generate this kind of amplitude as Feynman diagrams. Here, I've got a trivial propagator. So it means if here I was putting something different.
I don't understand the notation. So what are J's? So phi is a function of four
representations. Okay.
Okay, so if J is missing, it means that it should be there.
Yeah, 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 okay. Okay,
fine.
Okay. Okay. It's just okay, so from that, I mean, you see that if here I had put another, something different from one, the only thing it would change, it's, as I said, there's an ambiguity in the Bard-Crane model, but you can put any amplitude that you want, a function of J1, J2, J3, J4, here for the tetrahedra. So here, actually, I could make it more complicated. But, I mean, this is one example of group theory which generates exactly that one that I wrote there, with that normalization. So now what's interesting is that this guy can be written as coming from a field on SO4 or SO31. So now it's going to be a function of four group elements. And here I'm going to require that it is invariant under action on the left, on the right. And I'm going to take as action almost the same thing here. So the integral of phi squared plus lambda times phi, and here I've got all the integration from J1 to G10 of phi of, so here now, when I'm putting numbers, you're supposed to put a G in front. So the same structure. Five times. So what's interesting is that when you do the Fourier, when you go to use the Peter Weyl theorem and you go to the Fourier basis, you develop this function on the representation on the group, you're going to get exactly that action here. But here actually, when you do that, you're going to get BF theory. So you're going to get a 50J symbol here. So when you want to do the Bard-Crane model, you just have to impose one further constraint on the phi, is that each of these guys is actually invariant under the action of SO3. Meaning that I want phi to be, I can define a projector on SO3, which acting on a function like that is the integral of SO3 to the power 4 of phi G1 H1 G2 H2 and so on. I can also define the projector on intertwiners, which here it's a single integral over SO. Well, here I'm in Euclidean, it works also in the Lorentzian. And finally, I just say that for the Bard-Crane model, I must restrict myself to a field phi, which is in the image of the product of these projectors. The only subtlety here is that usually, so to, if you want something which is in the image, you just act with this guy on a field, and I can write the action like that. Now the problem is that this product is not a projector. So each time I'm going to act on my field, I'm going to get non-trivial factors, which are going to depend on J1, J2, J3, and J4. And so it means that I've got a certain ambiguity when I write the action for Barycone model, and that ambiguity actually is simply the ambiguity of having some factors in here at the tetrahedrons. So you find the same ambiguity at all levels, which is kind of reassuring. But it's not very useful since you still have that ambiguity. So now this kind of theory, you might think it's kind of useless because just rewriting that as Feynman diagrams of this one. But it means that just like matrix models in 2D, you can now look at the Poisson function for that group field theory, and it will generate sums of a triangulation and sums of all topologies. And maybe we can do something useful with them. And using them is totally open. There's almost nothing done on it. So anybody interested, you can work on it if you want.
But why is this second formula more useful than this first?
Well, because you don't have a tangent symbol appearing like something ugly in here. Because here what's really difficult is the tangent symbol, whereas here it's an integration of some product of field on the group. So it seems very simple. Yeah. So that's all I wanted to say.
If you want to derive the Feynman diagram, it's convenient to go back to this formula.
Yes, it's just that now you could just, instead of working in the representation, like putting representation on that, you could just work only at the group level, which makes things actually clearer. Like the stuff by Alejandro Perez, when he computed like some amplitudes for like bunch of force implices, he used only the connection representation, which makes everything simpler. So, yes.